to Artery, with Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In each episode of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist, specializing in a particular cultural context, has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of authorship and relational creativity in art. In this episode, Andrea Giolai, an ethnographer of Japanese performing arts based at the University of Leiden, speaks with sound and performance artist Tomoko Hojo. I'll now hand over to Andrea to introduce himself and his guest.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. My name is Andrea Giolai and I am an ethnographer specializing in Japanese performing arts at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. Today, I'm joined by Tomoko Hojo. Thank you, Tomoko.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for doing this interview in English as well. Tomoko is an artist working at the intersection of sound, music, and performance. And she uses composition, score-based, and improvised performances, but also installations and academic research. Through all of these different media, Tomoko explores how women's voices have been silenced, focusing especially on archives as sites of power and tensions. Tomoko reimagines undocumented works from past artists, and she has worked extensively on Ono Yoko, and she gives these works a new sound and a new shape. So hello, how are you, and where are you speaking from today?
Hi, I'm in Belgium, Brussels right now, because I got a grant from Japanese Art Foundation. And I started to be here since February, and how many months has already passed?
Almost four to five months,
yeah.
Great, that's great. Thanks for doing this online. So would you mind introducing yourself briefly to our listeners, and can you tell us a little bit about your work in general?
Okay, I didn't expect that. As Andrea already mentioned, I'm working with sound, and my work having a different forms of improvisation. Sometimes I do a musical composition and sound installation. And since 2018, I started to work on the theme of silenced women's voices, and whose voices are missing and whose voices are more audible. And you know, based on that historical research, like women, especially the women who have relation with foreign countries, the Western countries, such as Yoko Ono or Sadayako Kawakami. And I do the archival research, and based on that, I create either performances or installations or concerts or whatever. The reason why I'm here actually in Belgium, because I wanted to explore the different possibility of expanding my work. I've been working as a freelance artist since 2017, and of course, it's so nice to work by my own, but sometimes I feel I have to learn something new, because I feel that I have a limitation of the way that and how I work. And you know, it's maybe nice to develop my own style, but at the same time, it's really nice to work with other people to learn from them. And I read the interview of a Belgian sound artist. Her name is Miriam van Imskoot. I never met her that time, and I just read through the interview. Then I found it interesting, because she was once, she built her career as a dance critic, but at some point she felt it's not her style, her things. And then she quit it and became an artist, and she started to do sound art. And I felt some kind of sympathy with that. And I felt it's so brave that somebody can quit one's career and start completely new. So yeah, this is the reason why I'm in Belgium. Recently I had collaboration with her. I'm now starting to make an own project for the autumn.
That's very interesting. Thanks very much. I would like to ask you a question about one of your recent works, or at least the format that it took is recent, mm-hmm. Which is Unfinished Descriptions. Mm-hmm. Of course, this is originally an exhibition in London in 2018, and it's now taken a different form as a record collection of scores that you commissioned to 30 different artists, and also there is an accompanying booklet. Can you tell me a little bit about this project as a whole?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, that I started to work on the theme of silence movement's voices in the history in 2018. This was the starting point of why I'm starting work on this theme. It's because then I was in London and my supervisor was Kathy Venn, and she was working on the similar stuff. And I started to kind of follow her activities, and I wanted to make something for my own. And also it's a duty, you know, for the Art Foundation, because they, you know, give me money, then I have to do something at the end. And I've been thinking about, you know, what can I do, what kind of theme that I can work on. Then I wanted to work on something related to my identities, and something that's meaningful, why I have to do these things in London. And as I'm working on experimental music, especially something working on the scores, graphic score or textual score, I wanted to kind of make a reference which is related to that theme as well. And okay, so then when I think about London, as an Asian woman, something Asian woman, something in graphic school and textual school, the avant-garde music or whatever, then I had an idea, maybe Yoko Ono could be an example. But then, like 2 seconds later, this idea came up, I denied. Because for me, the Yoko was too famous. And then, other 2 seconds later, I can question myself, okay, why do I have to deny Yoko Ono? It's because she's famous. I mean, I didn't know about her that much. I only knew some like surface information that she's the wife of John Lennon. And she is known as a kind of eccentric woman. But she's also like kind of working as an avant-garde artist. And she made a book called Grapefruit, which is a collection of a text score published in 1964. But then I thought, okay, this is just my prejudice towards her. And I never heard actually her voices before. Then I've been to the British Library to looking for her voice. And then what I found was her nodding or back channeling. Mm-hmm. So it's not really her voice, but more like an accompanying the John Lennon speaking, even though that interview was made for two of them. So I was quite shocked about this fact, and I thought she was more like a pushing lady to say, yeah, I thought she can really insist on what she wants to say, but seems like at least on that recording, it doesn't sound like that way. Yeah. So then I made a piece based on this experience that I had at the British Library. It's called I'm Listening to You. And departing from that work, I wanted to make an installation or exhibition, which happened at the 100 Years Gallery, the basement of the gallery. And especially I'm focusing on her past exhibition she did in 1966 at Indic Gallery. And this is the first exhibition that she made, and it's also famous for the place where John and Yoko met. And at the end, I made 7 different pieces, including this I'm Listening to You. And as Andrea mentioned, I also asked 30 people to reimagine one of the missing works in her catalog. And also we did a performance, it's a collaboration with the British performer Andy Ingemans. And yeah, it was a really short exhibition, actually only 3 days, but I wanted to spread this work and this collection of the scores and, you know, the fact that I did this exhibition to the wider audience. That's why I made this catalog. recently.
違う。準備してたの。オープニング前で。66オープニング前で。大丈夫、ファイン。大丈夫、ファイン。ファイン。ファイン。ファイン。大丈夫。大丈夫。ファイン。違う。新鮮なリンゴ、あの白、新鮮なリンゴ、そしてファイン白。
I was preparing before the opening.
ファイン。インディカギャラリ
ー。Since you touched upon wanted to work with others at the very start of the conversation.I will ask you immediately this question that I was thinking of keeping for later, but I will just ask it now, I guess. Could you tell me a little bit how you felt about this collaborative element in the project? You involved a lot of different artists by asking them to work on a piece, but also in your performances...as well, you sometimes collaborate. So I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that element, and also in connection to that, if you can tell us a little bit how you feel about authorship in these cases, you know. And authorship, I think, is quite a crucial word, keyword in your work, I guess. So this is really two big questions in one, but
yeah,
yes.
Of course.No, the authorship is very important, and as you said, I think I'm trying to erase my authorship as much as possible. The reason why I'm working with historical element is because I don't want to push myself so much, you know, what I feel and what I'm thinking, but I would like to make a connection with historical facts, and then one gives some kind of insights myself, what I feel and what I think, and asking the people the question through artwork. And in terms of the collaborative work that I do, it really depends. Sometimes I have my own idea and want to ask somebody to join. In that case, I still keep my authorship and then give them the role.And we can do it together. But sometimes, as working as a duo with Swiss artists, in that case, as we are duo, only two of us there, we're quite equal. We don't really divide into the roles. So one can say something and the other one can respond. The other one can say something, the other one can respond. Sometimes, you know, maybe like 60% of the work that is ideas coming from the one person and 40%, but we don't really, you know, taking care. It's okay. It really depends. Somebody, I mean, also it's dependent on location. The project happened in Japan.Maybe then I have more information than she has, because obviously I'm Japanese, she's not. So it's really dependent, we don't care about this case. But the one that I just mentioned, the project with Miriam, the Belgian artist, recently I joined, this was very different because it's not really my work. Even I joined as one of the artists, it's more like collaborative.
Do you...feel like being the author of a work is an important concept for you and the people and your research? I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about this notion of, you know, there is this expression birthing the work, even in English, which makes it almost as a burden that falls onto the artist.To give birth to the work, and it's very romantic in a way, yeah. Right? And maybe very European or Euro-American, I don't know. But I wonder how you feel about this notion of producing, creating, making something, and how do you relate it to what you just said about trying to erase yourself?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we have to take responsibility, right? If they want to present something under my name, and I'm not anonymous, I'm using my real name, Tomoko Hojo. So when I do something, of course, I care so much, very much, and how people will think about it. And as I've been working as an artist, I don't want to just do some, I don't want to present some rubbish, right? I want to keep my aesthetics as I wish. But the thing is just framing, I think, how much that I want to control this work. Mm. And if like 100%, you know, there's, I don't know, the work, it is full of full of intention. This artist really wants to deliver this work as it is. As this 100%, in a way, it's really nice that the artist could realize that and, you know, make this work possible. But in a way, for an audience, maybe they wanna explore something new possibility, rather than the direction that the artist wanted to show. And I think I'm really careful about this space or the concept of ma, in Japanese. I'm not trying to say everything in a work. So if it's 100%, I'm trying to be like a 50%. Because if there's no 50% emptiness inside the work, in a way it's so boring. As I said, it's more like a pushing. People may feel, okay, this is Tomoko Hojo, but I don't like that work because there's no space that I can be in. Mm. I can enter, I can't really put my own color on it. And this is actually what Yoko Ono was trying to do. Her work is really simple, lots of spaces, but it's really strong. So this is what I'm reaching out. Of course, it's not that easy because many artists want to add more things on it. Artists feel fears. If it's not enough, then people feel, oh, what is this? It's just a piece of paper, a piece of wood. Or, you know, if it's so simple, then we really think, oh, maybe it's not enough. We have to add more and we have to decorative. It's more like Instagram. Mm-hmm. It's good for Instagram or whatever, but actually it's not the point. It's really surfacey. And if the concept is strong and reassured, an artist is sure, okay, this is the core part that I want to show. And there's a spaces, enough spaces for people to interpret themselves or to add their own thought on the top of the work, then I think it's great work. Mm.
Okay, that's fascinating. Thank you. Mm. So in a way, sorry, I might be overinterpreting this, but what I'm also hearing that a little bit of erasing yourself from the picture is also giving that space, like letting that space in the work, mm-hmm. in a way. I also wonder if we can't maybe talk a little bit more specifically about unfinished description, because I think it would give listeners a better sense of your work and the themes that innerve your work. Could you please tell us what the title refers to, unfinished description, and in particular 30 versions of 014, right? Which we were talking about before. Yeah, could you give us a little bit of background and maybe describe your process with that piece, which is, you know, kind of a phantom piece in a sense.
The title of the unfinished description is coming from the original title of Yoko Ono's exhibition in 1966. It's called Unfinished Paintings and Objects. So it's also related to the topic we just talked about. So unfinished. So it's not finished. It's not finished by an artist. It's finished, will be finished when audience will join. And the reason why I wanted to put in the descriptions, because I've been doing research about her articles, how mass media wrote about her, and also the works that she has been published or presented so far. In a way, it's never, you know, description is never finished. It's, I mean, history is never finished, as you know. it's always kind of rewriting, and you know, there's always possibility of revising that fact which we thought it was correct. And it depends on how you tell the story and from which position. If you're American, that you write in history from the American point of view, even the Japanese, of course, it's different in a way of writing history. And you know, it's a complete, like if the 100 people there, then 100 different way of writing stories or histories. So that's why I put this unfinished description, which is related to her exhibitions. And the process of the O14, which you just mentioned, so O14 is one of the works written in the catalogue that she published after this exhibition, 1966. And as I said, the original exhibition, there's the paintings and objects, and each work has a serial number. If it's object work, it's O1 or O2, blah, 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 the titles. And this painting, the P1 or P2, you know, there's a serial number. And O14 didn't have any titles. It was just serial number. So it must be objects, number 14, but it's not the title. And when I found this serial number in the catalog, I found that, okay, it might be just a mistake. You know, it happens when you make a catalog. Maybe it didn't intend to put it, but somehow these mistakes happen. But in a way that I found that it's interesting to use this fact. Maybe it didn't exist in the reality, this work, but it exists in the catalog. Then why not I use these elements for reimagining the fact that we wouldn't know. I mean, I wasn't there. Not many people there. I asked around people, do you remember this exhibition? Because I also interviewed with gallery owner of the original exhibition that she had, and he didn't remember at all. So maybe somebody remember, but really it might be not possible to know what was the reality, what was a fact.
True.
The sure thing is this was existing in the catalog. Then I decided not making this work by myself, but helping out other people's imagination. So I asked 30 artists, which is related to London, which is related to UK, many people who I met during my stay in London. Some of them are composer, some of them are writer, some of them are poet, some of them are curator. So, you know, it's a different type of people. Then I gave them a list of words, which is coming from the articles which have been researched. So some words it's used for describing Yoko Ono, or some words it's coming from the catalog that she made. So it's like a list of words. I don't know how many words it was. It's like more than 100 words. And I ask them, at least, please use one word from the list. Other thing is, anything is possible. And then as you can see in this catalog that I made, there's very different type of words, instructions. And I found it fascinating.
It is fascinating, very much so. And it's the creative process itself is mysterious on the one hand, but playful on the other hand. I find it very, very interesting. The outcomes are so different one from the other. Mm-hmm. And then maybe listeners should also know they can find on YouTube, they can find a performance of some of these pieces, so they mm-hmm. can also maybe compare.
Thank you.
Okay, so in relation to these issues of authorship, but also archive that we've been exploring now, the piece itself and the project that revolves around this particular piece makes me think of experimentation that comes from earlier decades, right? In the tradition of Fluxus, with Yoko Ono's own instruction pieces, but also in line with other experiments like the magazine Women's Work, for example, from the 70s, which had performance scores by very famous artists like Xiaomi Mieko, Anna Lockwood, Paulina Oliveiros, Alison Knowles, and others. So do you feel connected to this particular tradition within 20th century art?
Sure. Yeah, because I think my career started from reinterpreting this kind of experimental type of music, especially written in a graphic or text form. So yes, it's kind of the basement of my practice, I'd say.
Also in line with provocative questions, you use a big variety of mediums in your work. Do you consider yourself a sound artist, and or what is your relationship to your mediums, actually?
It's a difficult question. You know, I all the time has to change. Depends on which grant I apply for. You know, it's quite practical things, but it's quite important. Because as my piece is quite intermediate, sometimes, as I said, I do composition, sometimes I do installation. And you know, if I say composer, then when I apply for the grants for the more finite stuff, then people don't think, oh, if she's a composer, maybe it doesn't fit into this condition. And if I said artist, then when I apply for the musical side of the grants, then people think, oh, it's an artist, maybe not. So I have to find in the middle point. That's why I said an artist, but especially to specify what kind of medium I use, at least for all of the works that I make, is sound. That's why I said sound artist. But I don't think this is the best description to express myself. Because again, the definition of sound art itself is very broad. And it's not fixed. And sometimes people think I was sound art and maybe this person is too technical, or, you know, it's a very different imagination everyone have. So I don't know what is the best way, but I just use sound artist because it's convenient.
Sure. Okay, I see. So sound is in a way a constant in exactly. a constant medium that you've used.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't consider sound as an essentially different medium from others that you might use? Is that?
I think it's essential, yes, because sometimes I work with the visuals, but it always comes after the sound. The sound comes first, even though the work itself doesn't have any sound. When I think first, when I make a piece, it's a sound. What kind of sound will be there? Will it be silent? Will it be whispering voices? It depends, but yeah, it comes first.
Okay, very interesting. And yeah, I wonder also if you can tell us, if you can talk a little bit about collaborating with, or future collaborations, I should say. So you've described a little bit what you are engaged in right now in Brussels, or in Belgium anyway. But I am definitely curious about what makes you excited about right now, recently. What kinds of things are you thinking through?
Yes, actually right now that I'm preparing for a plan, the installation plan that I have to submit for the competition. This is based on my performance work that I made last year in New York. It's called Whispered Screaming. And this work is based on my research about Yoko Ono's screaming voices, because I've been working on her exhibitions, like in the 60s, in London, in Tokyo. She had different exhibitions, and I kind of used that material for producing my work. But this is more like fine art context. But I never really touched about her musical activities, even though it was also very crucial for her activities. Then I realized, then I have to work on that. Then I used her screen voices. I transcribed everything, but I used my whispering voice to reproducing it. It's because I wanted to express the situation that I felt in New York, that is mainly an Asian hate. Yeah, unfortunately, I think still now it might be the similar situation, but because of Corona, because of, pressures and everyone has, the violence towards Asian or towards, powerless people, the woman or child or every people was really visible. And I felt real fear. I never had this experience before in my life. And also, the war between Russia and Ukraine started. And, like an accumulation of the fear or anger or some kind of feeling, I want to scream, but I can't really scream in loud voice. This was leading to me deciding that why I wanted to use this whispering was yet screaming voices. I kind of explained too long, but so this was a performing piece. Now I'm trying to reinterpret it as an installation piece. I don't know if it may happen or not, but at least, thinking about an idea, new idea, based on the previous project, interesting. And I have different projects in different places as well. So I don't know if I should explain.
Well, I was curious about process, to be honest, because I had conversations with other artists. And I'm thinking about one person in particular who told me that they became sort of obsessed with a theme or a topic and worked out that topic over a span of several years, four or 5 years. And then there was a moment of transition, in a sense, where they felt, I am transitioning towards a different block in my career, I suppose. Does that ring a bell? Is that something that you also find, or does it work differently for you? Because it also seems like your output is very consistent over the years at the same time. It's varied, it's different, but the themes, I can retrace them.
Yeah, I think with continuing several years, the thing gets strong. The work itself gets strong, the project itself gets strong. And I think instead of, working on different things, of course, sometimes I have to do, because, there's some commissions and it's completely different contexts, so the theme is maybe not about Yoko Ono, but something else, but it's also fine that I like to do it. But in a way, if there's a one line, a consistent line, that I can always come back, then I feel kind of comfortable, you know, as a freelance artist. It could be really nomadic and so much like floating everywhere. But if there's a line, you know, it's nice to, yeah, make a home or like, I don't know, like a place where I can go back.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. A very beautiful image to think of one's work as also being maybe apartments or homes around the world that you can go back to every once in a while. I thought as you were describing your current, what's currently exciting for you and what you're working on and for the future, I had a revelation in a sense that there is quite a lot of technology that is a phantom presence in your work. Your work is, on the one hand, very embodied and bodily, physical. I think you need to, well, you don't need to see it necessarily, maybe, or you can say something about that if you like, but there is an element that is kind of typical of happenings, for example, where you are there at that moment and something happens as well, but then there is also recording those moments and there's manipulating those recordings. There's all kinds of levels, of course, but it is a very physical, embodied corpus. At the same time, there is a sense that without technology, much of it maybe could not happen in the way that you want it to happen. So can you talk a little bit about your relationship with technology in maybe in relation with, yeah, your projects?
Yeah, technology. Yeah, so I'm never really say myself when I'm a sound artist using lots of technology, because I know more like technical oriented people. So in that case, it's really true that my works is very much related to the real bodies, which is confronting in front of people. But at the same time, yes, that's really true. The recordings is so important because I'm working a lot with archives. This project, of course, wouldn't be happened without the technologies of the recordings. And it's, yeah, sure, in that case, and I'm very much involved in this, but I never really think myself technology first. It's always, there's a kind of wish or the concept that I want to achieve, and to think about, okay, how can I achieve this? Then technology will help.
I have a final question. This one of the themes of this podcast series, both this season and the one before, is relational, what we call relational creativity. I wonder, maybe this is provocative, maybe not, I'm not sure, but I wonder, since you've worked for several years with and about Ono Yoko, with her work, with her body of work, and about her, do you feel like you have a relationship with this person? Is what kind of, how do you feel about, are you a duo in a sense?
No, I don't think I'm a duo. She's too great. I mean, it's maybe not equal, but I have a very strong connection, even though I've never met her. And yeah, in a way, it's a weird feeling. I mean, it's not because we are coming from the same country, Japan, but over time, even though we don't meet each other in real time, but we can really know through seeing or through knowing someone's thoughts, someone's writing about what kind of person she is or this person is. And in a way, this way of connection is really fruitful to me. And for sure, I mean, you have the same feeling when you read some writings that you really like and you feel you are attached to the author, but when the same things happen towards an artworks when you go to the museums, you don't know about this person at all, but somehow you feel empathy with this person or the work, and this bond is really strong. And yeah, with doing different researches and reading her writings, sure, this feeling is getting stronger and stronger.
That's very interesting. Does it change your perception of yourself as a as the author of your work? Because I keep returning to this theme of authorship simply because I find it quite central. It's like but it's also full of mirrors in a way, you know, when you are in, when you take any of your pieces, you can see all kinds of reflections on doubling, but also embodying persons. So authorship and authoriality become very fuzzy concepts in a way. They are paradoxically both very focused because that's what the piece talks about oftentimes, but they're also the notion itself becomes quite fuzzy. The borders are a little bit difficult to define. Do you want to say any closing thoughts on this? Or is the fuzziness, perhaps the question is the fuzziness important for you in terms of authorship and
can I interpret the fuzziness as like an indeterminacy?
Of course, it's your work and you are the artist.
Yeah, it's difficult, but yeah, I think it's important to have this element in it. As I said, if it's really sure, okay, this work is made by this person, and of course it is. If it's written, then it's clear, right? If it's work by blah, blah, blah. But lots of works, actually, it's not only made by this person. And like artworks, there's a, you know, people who made a frame, for example, if it's paintings, and they made a canvas, and if it's more installation, for sure that the person who helped installing. I think it's it's the concept of what is a work, from which point we regard as artwork, from which point we say this is a creator or author of this work. Of course, if we say the author is only person who had an idea, then it's clear. But artwork itself is not only that, right? If it's a concept, we have to make things in a reality. In that case, so many people involved. So I like an idea not having this authorship only one person, but to maybe questioning who is the author and what is the creator of the art. It's not only one person. It's nowadays, it's very and yeah, I think it's these things that makes the concept of the art dissolving, not only like in modern art, but when it goes to the contemporary art, there's so many different ways, and especially in the performance outside or like participatory work, you know, everything's mixed. I mean, yeah, who can decide, who can say that this work is made by this person? If it's an idea, of course, we can always say this is came up with an idea by blah, 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 blah. But I think it's not important nowadays. We should forget about this.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we can stop here. And thanks very much for joining the podcast. And all the best for your future work. We'll be listening.
Thank you so much.
This was Artery with Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship and anthropology, supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. hope to speak with you again soon.